Good morning. Wake up. That was for me, not for you. Welcome to Xenos East. I'm glad to see everybody here. We're going to continue our series in 1 Corinthians. We're in chapter 13 today. I encourage you to turn there in your Bibles and follow along. One of these days, I'm going to put up the wrong passage on purpose to see if anybody notices. Maybe today. We'll see. So while you're turning there, I'm going to pray real quick. Lord, I thank you for today, and I thank you for passages like this one. This is one of my favorites. This is such a beautiful piece of scripture, and we can learn on so much from your word, and so much of it is just summed up in 1 Corinthians 13. I pray today that I can be clear, that you don't let my clumsy words get in your way, that you can speak through me, and I pray that we have a good discussion and good time for prayer afterwards as well. Amen. All right, so 1 Corinthians is a letter that Paul wrote, as you know if you've been here for a while. He wrote this letter to this church in Corinth, and they had a lot of morality issues going on there. The town itself was pretty immoral, very secular, very Greek and Roman oriented, and so the churches there are too. And so he is addressing a lot of the morality issues, but this is the funny thing about this church is, even though they've got some problems, they've also got a lot of gifts. It's a very gifted church. He says at the beginning of the letter that they've been gifted with every spiritual gift. They're a very talented group of people, very charismatic. And last week, we looked at chapter 12, where Paul talks about spiritual gifts and how we should use them and why God gives us those gifts. And at the end of that chapter, he says something very interesting. He says, as awesome as these gifts are and as great as they are, he says, you should eagerly desire the greater gifts, but yet I will show you the most excellent way. And he's not doing a Bill and Ted thing, or his most excellent. He's really talking about a way that's even better, way of life that's more than being focused on our spiritual gifts. It's really how everything we do as Christians should come out of this way that he's going to talk about here in chapter 13. Sounds pretty good. So let's take a look at what he has to say. What we're going to do is we're going to read through the whole chapter. It's short, don't worry. We're going to read through the whole chapter, and then we're going to get into it a little bit more closely. He says, this may sound familiar to you, some of it anyway. He says, if I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but I do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy, and I know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith, so as to remove mountains, but I do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but I do not have love, it profits me nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant. It does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own and is not provoked. It does not take into account a wrong suffered. It does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. And at this point, everyone turns around and looks for the bride, right? Because this is very often read at weddings. That's probably why it sounds familiar. Interestingly enough, though, this has nothing to do with weddings. I mean, this is a great model for love, for weddings, and for marriages. But there's nothing about marriage here. So let's read on. He says, love never fails. But if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. And if there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child and think like a child, reason like a child. But when I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but I will know fully, just as I have been fully known. Now faith, hope, love abide in these three, but the greatest of these is love. What a beautiful passage. What a beautiful, I mean, this is one of the best things I think that's ever been written in paper. It's fantastic. And he's talking about love here. And if we read it in context, he's not talking about how you have a better marriage, although it applies there. It applies to all of our relationships. The thing that he's talking about here, if you pay attention, is he's talking about how love will transform us, and how love changes us. He says, I used to be childish, but now I put that stuff aside when I became a man. And he's talking about how we mature as Christians, as human beings, through love. And so that's what we're going to focus on. We want to take a look back through this passage now, a little more slowly, and see what how love can transform us. Because remember, this Corinthian church, these people here, they needed to be transformed. And he's addressed some major spiritual issues with these folks. They were very selfish. I mean, they were getting drunk at their meetings, and they were having incestuous relationships. I mean, it was a mess. And he addressed those things, but he's focused here now. I mean, this is it. I mean, this is how we change. This is how they're going to get better. If you want to know how you can become better, become a better person, it's right here in this passage. Let's take a look a little more closely. Back at the beginning, he says, if I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I do not have love, I have become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I surrender my body to be burned, but do not have love, it profits me nothing. All right, so in context, remember last week, chapter 12, he was talking about all their spiritual gifts. And here they come up again, some of them. He's talking about speaking with the tongues of men and of angels. He's talking about having the gift of prophecy. Having all knowledge, which is a spiritual gift, the knowledge, and a spiritual gift of faith. He says, if I have all of these things and I don't have love, then what do I have? Nothing, right? He's going back to these spiritual gifts, and he says, look, you people are so gifted. God has been so generous with the way he's treated you and given you so much, but if you don't have love, you don't have anything. Is that what it says? You have nothing? Take a closer look, because that's how I always read it. If I have these, but I don't have love, then I really have nothing. What he says is, if I have these gifts and I don't have love, I am nothing. I am nothing. That's a very personal thing to say, right? If you say to somebody, you're nothing, if you don't have love, you are nothing. That should get our attention. The Bible's very clear about how valuable we are. Each individual is valuable to God, extremely valuable. And he says, if we don't have love, we are nothing. That's pretty serious. That means that no matter how much I try, no matter how much I want to exercise the gifts that I have for God, if I'm doing it without love, I'm nothing. In fact, what he's saying is he defines us through love. And if we don't have that in our lives, if we don't have this kind of love that he's describing here in our lives, then there's something major missing in who we are. Not just what we have, but who we are fundamentally. And so he addresses in the first two verses, he talks about spiritual gifts and what people do with those spiritual gifts. And he goes on from there and he says, if I give all my possessions to feed the poor and if I surrender my body to be burned, but I do not have love, it profits me nothing. And so here he's talking not about spiritual gifts, but about ministries, about things that we do, ways we serve. Our work, in other words, the works that we perform, if we do them without love, then they profit nothing. And he's talking about some serious things. He's talking about, I mean, just as he was talking earlier about faith that could move mountains, I mean, that's pretty serious. He's saying, if I give everything I own, not just some, not just most, but everything that I own to feed the poor, but I do it without love, then it profits me nothing. If I surrender my body, even to martyrdom, if I die for a cause, if I do it without love, then it profits me nothing. Now, at first glance, you might think, well, that's neat to say, but I mean, could you even do those things without that kind of motivation? And I would argue that, of course. Of course. Of course you can. People do these things all the time for the wrong motivations, without love as their motivation. Love of self, perhaps. We can change and restrain ourselves temporarily if we have a good motivation. Right? I mean, I can be motivated to do certain things for a certain amount of time if I have the proper motivation, and usually it has to be a really good selfish motivation. It's not because I love, it's because I want something for myself. And if I want that more than I want this other thing, then I can conform to that for a time. So if I'm giving up my possessions for the poor, for example, I may be motivated by the way people view me. I may be motivated by the things that I think God will give me. If I do these things, if I give everything to the poor, then he's really going to reward me for that, right? Like the universe is some kind of vending machine. And if I put the right things in and push the right codes, then I will receive the things that I'm looking for. That's my motivation most of the time. People martyr themselves all the time. People are blowing themselves up. Why? Is it because they love their neighbor? I would argue that blowing yourself up along with your neighbors is not the way to properly love them. I mean, we can debate that if you'd like later, but I'm pretty sure that's not how you love your neighbor. No, it's not for that. It's because they think that they're going to receive something on the other side. So yeah, you can do these things. What he says, though, is it profits me nothing. And that's how we know that he's talking. He's talking about profit here. We're doing it for the wrong motivations if you're doing it for profit. Love is sacrificial. And so what he's talking about here is all of these things that we can do, all these gifts that we have if we don't use them with love, all the things, the work that we do, if we're not doing it out of love, then we're missing something major. And it's easy to overlook this passage, this little point right here where he says you've become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. It's easy to overlook that. And you look at that and he's saying, well, if you're speaking in tongues or whatever, and then it's just, you're just making noise if you're doing it without love. But it's a little bit more than that. The pagans at the time, this is during the height of Roman Empire, and Corinth was one of the major cities in the Roman Empire, and they had all these pagan temples. And part of the worship they did in those pagan temples was they had to get the gods' attention. So they would go to the temple of Hermes or the temple of Zeus or whoever, and they would do whatever rituals they felt like they had to do, and a lot of that involved gongs and cymbals. Not cymbals with an S, but cymbals with a C, like from a drum kit. They'd make these noises to get the god's attention so the god would pay attention to what they're doing and maybe give them what they want. And he's drawing a line to these things that we do without love as our motivation, all of our works. And he's saying, you're basically worshiping at a pagan temple when you're doing it just to get God's attention. If you're doing work, if you are serving people, even if you're doing amazing things like faith that moves mountains and giving all of your stuff to the poor, if you're doing those things for the wrong motivations, if you're trying to get God's attention with your work, then it's useless. And worse than that, you are nothing. That's a pretty big accusation, because I think if we're honest, a lot of the times we want recognition for the things that we do. If we're serving, look, if I moved a mountain with my faith, I want people to notice. And the other day, I crumpled up something and threw it across the room, and it went right in a trash can, and no one was around to see it. And I thought, oh, man, what's the point? We set up cameras. We carry cameras, video cameras around with our phones, and we film everything we do just in case something happens cool that people will notice, right? We want to be noticed. And we're trying to get God's notice, God's attention. And if you're doing it just to get his attention, to get something from him, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. That's not how God relates to us. He's not a vending machine. He's a being. He's a personal being. Jesus had the same message for his disciples. He has the same message for them. He was telling them about the day of judgment, when he returns and brings judgment to the world. And he says to them, this is in Matthew 7, many people will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. They're saying to him, Lord, I did all of this work. And it's amazing work. It was miraculous work. We did all of this for you. And Jesus says to them, I don't know you. What does that tell you about who gets into heaven? Is it the people who do all the work? The people who serve? And people who devote their lives to getting work done for the Lord? Or is it people who know him? The people who have a loving relationship with him? Which is it? According to Jesus, it's people who love him. That's why love is so important. There's this old parable about a king, and he has he's got his retainers around him, and this humble farmer comes up with this giant carrot. It's just a carrot, but it's a big one. And he says, you know, king, this is the biggest carrot I've ever made. This is the biggest carrot I've ever grown in my field, and I brought it because I love you, and I want to honor you with this carrot. And the king looks at him. He says, well, that's pretty amazing. And he says, you know what I'm going to do for you? He says, I've got these fields. I'm going to put you in charge of all my farms. I'm going to put you in charge. I'm going to bless you with hundreds of acres so you can prosper on my fields. And one of his retainers is sitting there, and he's a rich guy. And he's like, huh, he gave him all that for a carrot? He says, this is a good deal. So the next day, he comes to him, and he says, with a horse. He says, this guy brought a carrot. I'll bring a horse. He says, king, he says, this is the best horse in my stables. I just want you to have it. And the king looks at him. He says, thanks. And that's it. And the guy looks disappointed. He says, well, the farmer came and he just had a carrot. And you gave him farms. He says, I come in here with you with this gorgeous horse. What's the deal here? And the king says, well, the difference is the farmer gave me the carrot. You were giving yourself the horse. You see the difference? One was motivated by love. He wanted to serve the king because he loved the king. The other guy wanted to serve the king because he loved himself. That's what our works amount to if we do them without love. Reading on, he says, love is patient. Love is kind and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant. It does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. This is an interesting list. I don't think this is a complete list of everything that love is. I think this is Paul saying to the Corinthians, here's a list of the things that you're not, right? You're not patient. You're not kind. You're jealous. You brag and you're arrogant. Remember, I mean, if you've been here through this series, you know all of these things are things that came up, right? That he's addressed already in this letter of their arrogance. And they're acting unbecomingly. They're getting drunk at their meetings. They seek their own. They're easily provoked. They take into account wrong suffered. Remember, they were taking each other to court. All the time, they were suing each other. They rejoiced in their unrighteousness. They said, look at all this sin that's going on in our church. Isn't it great? We're forgiving. We're full of grace. That's what they were doing. This is a list of all the things that the Corinthians were not. Issues that they've had in their church. And instead of saying, well, you need to be more patient. You need to be more kind. You shouldn't be so jealous. What did he do? He didn't just give them a list. You need to do this better. You need to do this better. You need to do this better. That's not what he did. Instead, he personifies love here. He says love is patient. It is kind. He's talking about a person here. And I've heard it said, and it's a great exercise if you want to get to know who God is, to replace the word love with God. Because God is love. God is patient. God is kind. He's not jealous. You see, he doesn't brag. He's not arrogant. That's a pretty good way to get to know God. But I think Paul here is talking about somebody specific. More, it's easy to say that about God, and he's kind of out there. But how could he write something like love is patient? This word that translates as patient, the Greek word is makrothumeo. Macro means long. Thumeo means suffering. It means long suffering. Not just patient, but going someone who can go through suffering for a long period of time without seeking for retribution. That's what this word really means. long-suffering. And how could he write about long-suffering without thinking of the man who said this about the ninth hour when Jesus was being crucified? He cried out with a loud voice saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which is, my God, why have you forsaken me? How can you talk about suffering without thinking about this? About Jesus Christ. And at this point, he's crying out that God has forsaken him, because literally at this point, Jesus is going through hell for us. Literally going through hell. I'm not talking about figurative hell. I'm talking about real hell. The Bible tells us a lot about hell, and a lot of it uses figurative language about fire and brimstone and that kind of thing. But I don't think that hell is literally filled with fire any more than I think the heaven is literally paved with streets of gold. It might be. I mean, I'm not saying it's not. What I'm saying is the Bible has to use fantastic language and figurative language to describe these things because they're so far out of our experience. So, for example, heaven is so great and so magnificent, so awesome to be in the presence of God, that the things that we hold so dear here on earth, like gold and gems, are just basic building materials there. We don't even care about them. They're just streets. That's how awesome heaven is by comparison. And then when he talks about hell, hell is really the absence of God. It's not just described in terms of fire. It's also described, Jesus called it, the outer darkness. And what it means is it's the absence of God. Hell is not just a torture chamber for people who don't obey God. What it is, it's God giving people what they want, which is not him. People who have chosen, they don't want to follow God. They want to do their own thing, so he puts them in a place where they're separated from him, which is exactly what they want. And that separation from God is so terrible that they used language like being eternal flames as describing how painful it is to be separated from our Creator. Who knows that better than Jesus, who is part of the Creator? And yet, for you and for me, he went to the cross and was separated from God. Long-suffering. A torture that you and I can't even imagine. I mean, the crucifixion, the physical crucifixion was bad enough, but he's there separated from God. My God, why have you forsaken me? Because he's doing it for you and I, so we don't have to be. We all should be receiving that separation from God because we all have chosen to follow our own paths instead of his. And yet Jesus did it for us. That is love. How can he describe love as long-suffering without thinking about Jesus? How can he describe love as not taking into account a wrong suffered without thinking of the man who was saying as they were nailing him to the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." That verb that he was saying, it means he was continually saying, as they were whipping him, every lash, "Forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Every time that nail, the hammer struck the nail, to nail him to the cross, "Forgive them, Father. They don't know what they're doing." Talk about not taking into account wrongs suffered. He is the personification of love. How can he describe love as hoping in all things, having a hope for the future, without describing the man who, while he's hanging on the cross, says to the guy next to him, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." Paradise probably seemed pretty far off at that point when they were nailed to the cross. But Jesus hoped all things. Love and hope, what that means in the Bible is not just "I hope something gets better." It's just not some vague thing. It means I know what's coming and I'm looking forward to it. He was assured of the future. He knew what was happening. He hopes all things. He knows what's coming. How can he describe love as saying love never fails without thinking of the man who was on the cross, and when he received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished," and he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And when that word translated as "it is finished," tetelestai, it's a Greek word that they would stamp on paperwork that showed it was something was completed. Usually, it could be a certificate, like a debt, like your deed was paid. Your mortgage was paid off. Usually what this is referring to is a certificate of debt to the state. So if you were a criminal, you would get this is a list of all of your crimes. And then once you served your time, whether it was imprisonment or pulling oars in a galley or whatever, they would nail that to wherever you were, or if you're being crucified, they would nail it to your cross. And once your debt was paid, your time was served, or once you were killed on the cross, they would stamp it with "Tetelestai, it is finished." Paid in full. It is complete. Love never fails. Jesus waited until the moment when all the sin was paid for, all of our debt, because he didn't have any of his own. He endured that suffering for us until it was done, until his mission was accomplished, and then it was finished. He never failed. So Paul is reminding them, you are here because of love personified, Jesus Christ. If you're in here today and you don't know what it means to have a relationship with God, if you've always thought that just good people get into heaven, people who do the work, people put in the time, and you've never really considered what it means that Jesus died for our sins, this is what it means. You and I, all of us, have a certificate of debt that needs to be paid. And we can pay it, but it means hell. It means separation from God, because that's the choice we've made. We've made the choice to do our own thing instead of his. And he will give that to you. But he would much rather have a loving relationship with you. And so he says, you know what? All of that sin, I'm going to own that. I'm going to take that, and I'm going to pay for it myself through Jesus. And so now you and I can come to him, and all we have to do is say, God, I want his payment to apply to my debt. I can't do it myself. I want him to pay for my sins. That's what it means that Jesus is the way to God. He is the way. He is the truth. He is the life. No one goes to the Father but through him. That's what that means. Because only he can pay our debt. And so love, the transforming power of love in our lives begins not with us mustering up feelings for other people, but with God loving us through Jesus. That's how love transforms us. That's how love changes us. They had lost track of that. They thought, well, we've got all these great gifts. We can drink and be merry and have fun and do whatever we want. And Paul is reminding them, you are here because love came into the world and sacrificed for you. So when we look at this list about what love is, we should really be thinking about who love is. Love is a person who came and did some amazing things for you and I. That's how we get changed. And that's how we can become more patient and kind and so forth, by focusing on what he has done for us. Paul goes on and he says, love never fails, but if there are gifts of prophecy, they will be done away. If there are tongues, they will cease. If there is knowledge, it will be done away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will be done away. When I was a child, I used to speak like a child, think like a child, reason like a child. But when I became a man, I did away with childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I will know fully, just as I also have been known fully. Now faith, hope, love abide in these three things, and these three, but the greatest of these is love. So how he's talking about faith, hope, and love, and he says the greatest one of these things is love. And but you might say, well, faith and hope are pretty good. Why? What makes love better? And so he's describing why love is so important. Because when we really consider all the things that the Bible says are important, faith, hope, and love, the most important one is love, and there's a good reason for that, and he has a good argument. First of all, he says these other things are going to be done away with. They're going to be done away with. Faith and hope, gifts of tongues, that's going to cease. Our works will fade. The things that we've done will fade. And he says this thing that they will be done away with when the perfect comes. And now he's talking about the completion, that when the completion comes. And he's talking about Christ himself, when Christ returns at the end of the age and brings eternal justice, true justice to the world, and true judgment. The other things will fade away. He says, I will know fully, just as I have been fully known. So he's talking about here, think about what's going to happen. One day we will all meet our Maker. What is faith? Faith is trust that God exists and he is who he says he is. Do I need faith when he's standing right next to me? No. At that point, faith is gone, right? I don't need faith. Well, if I pick this up and let go of it, I don't have to have faith that it's going to drop to the ground, right? I know that it will because we're here. This is how the universe works. It will be no denying that God exists when he's right there. Faith is no longer necessary. Just as hope is no longer necessary. Hope, remember, is the assurance of things to come. But when they're here, I don't have to hope that I'll make it here today. I'm here. Right? Those are gone. What's left? Love. We are going to have an eternal relationship with our Creator and with one another. And that relationship is based around love, who is a person, who is the person that we will be intimately connected with. That's the only thing left. So the more we learn how to love, the better we learn how to love, the better suited we will be for our eternal destination. Part of learning to love is learning what it means to be an eternal being and how it will be to live in eternity. He says, then I will be fully known just as I will know fully just as I have been fully known. We will know. We won't have to question things. My wife and I talk about, we have a list. These are the things that I'm going to ask God when I meet him, right? What on earth were you thinking? Why ticks is her thing. Like, why do we even need such things, right? It's kind of funny. But we have this list. Well, we're going to fully know. He says, right now we know some things. It's like looking in a mirror dimly. It's like looking in a foggy window. I kind of know some things. He's given us some knowledge. He's given us some revelation. We know some things, but then we're going to know all. Just as I have also been fully known. How have I been fully known? This is shocking to me when I really consider what this is saying. God knows you. He knows me. I mean, we think we know ourselves. He knows us. He says at the beginning of Psalm 139, which was my favorite psalm, he says, Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, you understand my thought from afar. That's scary. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all of my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. What's he saying? He's saying, God, you know everything there is to know about me. You know where I'm going. You know where I've been. You know what I'm thinking and what I've thought. What I will think tomorrow. You know everything about me, every chromosome in my DNA. You know me. You know me. Right? And then I will know you. Just as well as you know me. How awesome is that? How awesome will it be to fully know God the way he fully knows us? To know where he's going and what he's thinking and what he's doing and why he's doing it. His thoughts are beyond our nature, beyond our understanding, but then we will understand. How amazing is that? How will that happen? Through love. Through love. That's why he can say the greatest of these things is love. Because that's the only thing left. That sounds like a pretty good deal, right? I want to get there. One day I hope to be able to love like that. I'm not there now. Certainly not. But how can we get to the point where we're laying aside childish things and becoming the adults we're designed to be? I remember the day I woke up as an adult, and I was no longer interested in anything else that was childish. Now, it was a great day. And can anybody say that seriously? Of course not. It didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen one day. I woke up, well, I'm 18 now. Time to get a job. You know, that's not how it works. I have teenagers. It's painful. It's painful. And then you know what? I'm an adult and it's painful still. I haven't laid aside all my childish things, as my wife will tell you. She'll say, you are 44. Like I need that reminder. Well, sometimes I must. How do we get there? How do we grow? How do we grow up in love? Well, I can't tell you that I have a definitive list. I can't say, oh, this is the thing that you need to do, and tomorrow you'll wake up and you'll be all better. I can't give you that. If I could do that, Paul, I would have given it to you out of what Paul wrote, but he didn't write that. Instead, he wrote them a letter that talks about how we grow and how we change. And the first thing he does is reminding them that they need to grow. They thought they were there. They thought they'd arrived. And he's reminding them, you have a long way to go. Our culture will tell you you're perfect the way you are. Just be yourself. Everything will work out. The power was within you all along. These are the messages that we received on cartoons. These are the things that we grow up with. These are the things that our generation that's coming into adulthood now just believes as granted. You're just fine the way you are. And if anyone tells you different, they're wrong. You're not fine the way you are. I'm sorry. Neither am I. None of us are. The things that we think are endearing character traits are very often character flaws. Things that we need to work on. God's not wanting to make us all as the same kind of person, but he does want us to grow as individuals and be better. He loves us the way we are, but he doesn't leave us the way we are. He wants us to grow. He wants us to change. He wants us to mature. And we should be able to admit that we have room for growth. We have these conflicting messages like, well, I'm human, nobody's perfect, while at the same time saying, I'm just fine the way I am. These are both given that we have in our culture that we accept without thought, and the truth is they are conflicting. Do we not understand that, right? If we're not perfect the way we are, there's room for growth. There's room to change. There's room to be better. We have to admit that. Next, I would encourage you to find your weaknesses. Find the areas. Look at that list. Am I patient? Am I kind? Do I take into account wrongs suffered? Am I jealous? I mean, these are the things that I need to be. Where am I weak? That passage that begins, that Psalm 139, where it begins, God, you know me. You know everything about me. It ends like this. He says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts and see if there be any hurtful way in me and lead me in the everlasting way. You see what he's saying? This is a great prayer. He says, this psalm, this is why I love it so much. He says, God, you know me better than anything. Teach me who I am. We think we know ourselves, but the truth is we are woefully blind to our own inadequacies. We are woefully blind to our own character flaws. Well, you may say, well, I know where my character flaws are, but you don't know all of them. And often the things we focus on are not the worst things going on in our lives. He's saying to God, you know me, teach me who I am. Teach me where I'm weak. Show me where I fail, and then make me better. He's asking God for help to change him, to make him more loving. What a great prayer. What a painful prayer to have answered. But love is long-suffering. Speaking of that, look for opportunities to practice love. Look for opportunities to practice love around you. Not just to love God. It's one thing to say, I love God, because he doesn't need anything from us. He's got everything in the universe at his disposal. He doesn't need anything, so he's not very demanding as far as that goes, as far as I need. He's not a needy person. But John says this in 1 John. He says, if someone says, I love God, and he hates his brother, he's a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. Learning to love means we need to look for opportunities around us to love other people, including long-suffering opportunities. There are so many memes and so many people out there in the world who would just say, well, you've got somebody toxic in your life. Get them out of there. They're no good for you. Life is about you, after all, and what's best for you is to reject anything in your life that is not easy, that is not nice, that is not pleasant. But love is long-suffering. How can love be long-suffering if we're not willing to suffer? If we're not willing to go through the heartbreak of loving someone who doesn't love us back, of loving someone who doesn't even understand what love really is. Love is long-suffering. It has to endure. C.S. Lewis talks about love and how he says love is painful. And the only way to really protect yourself from heartbreak is to not love at all, to wall your heart off from the world so that no one gets in and no one can hurt you and no one can betray you. That's the only way to protect yourself from heartbreak. It's also the quickest way to destroy your life. Because remember, without love, what are you? You're nothing. We have to be willing to suffer. And that doesn't mean that we stay in a broken relationship and let the abuse continue or something like that. That's not what love is. And that's not the advice I'm giving you. What I'm saying is we have to be willing to be hang in there with people when they're difficult. We have to be willing to serve people when they don't even know they're being served. We have to be able to love people in a difficult manner, speaking truth to them, cutting them off when it's necessary, that kind of thing. And even though it's painful to see them suffer because we love them, in the long run we'd have something better for them than to just sit there and be abusive. Love is painful, but we have to be willing to put up with that. How can we do that? How can we be in relationships with all these broken people who are willing to just stomp all over us for their own purposes, for their own wants and needs? How can we do that? Well, because we have the source of love. We know who love is. And because he loves us, because God is infinite in his love, we can then love others sacrificially. Monitor your progress. Have goals. I mean, we should be able to monitor to see if we're getting better in these areas. In another letter, this is in Galatians, Paul wrote that the fruit of the Spirit is love and joy, peace and patience and kindness, goodness and faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. He's talking about the fruit of the Spirit, the things that we receive from our relationship with God. It's not fruits. He doesn't say fruits of the Spirit are. And what this means is, via our relationship through God, we should grow in all these areas. Am I more patient? Am I more kind? Am I better morally? Am I more faithful? Am I more gentle than I was before? Do I have more self-control? Or we can look through the list we just looked at in 1 Corinthians 13. A lot of people will monitor their faith by the Ten Commandments. Well, I didn't murder anybody today, I'm good. No stealing for me today, right now, I'm okay. But that's not the true gauge of our relationship with God. That's not the true gauge of how we're growing. It's right here. It's this list of love. Am I better at loving? And it's not a day-by-day thing. It's a year-by-year thing. We've recently gone through some things in our marriage, in our life, that 10 years ago would have wrecked me, would have driven us to put us each other's throats. We moved. We would have killed each other if we'd have gone through that then. But, you know, this time around, we've grown because we've learned how to love one another a little bit better. Not perfectly, but better. Ask others for their honest input. How am I growing here? Have you seen growth in me? What does that suggest? They have to know you. They have to have been around you for a long period of time in a pretty deep relationship where they understand, not just, but they just see you in passing and say, well, I haven't seen him strangle anybody lately, so he must be doing pretty good. But they know you, they know where you're weak, they know where you're prone to sin, they know how you're prone to judge or whatever. And they're able to give you honest input. That means love. We have to be in these relationships for a long time in order to know if we're growing. Finally, if you want to grow up in love, and this is probably the most important thing, get to know who love is. Get to know who love is. In John, 1 John, he says, let us love one another, for love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. The one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. To abide in something means to live in it, to have it part of you. So if you're going to play Monopoly, you have to abide by the rules, right? Otherwise, it's just nonsense. To abide in God means we're living according to him, with him in mind, with him at the forefront of our thoughts. That's how we love. How? Why? Because he is love. He's the source. He's the fountainhead. We can't receive love anywhere else. Willie Nelson was looking for love in all the wrong places. He couldn't find it because he didn't know who love was. We are looking for love in all the wrong places. We look for it in our relationships with human beings, and we think, "Why can't I finally found someone who loves me and who I love them?" And eventually, that breaks down. Why? Well, because we think love is something that we fall into, like it's an accident, and we can slip and fall out of it. But there is nothing in these lists of love that says it's an accident. In fact, they're all active verbs. Even the word patience was long-suffering. That's active. I have to actively put up with a lot of stuff. Love is a decision that we make on an ongoing basis. And that decision has to start right here. We have to look for love in the right places. And when we receive it from God, then we can give it to others. We need to spend time with Christ and with his people. Spend time in prayer. Spend time in his word. Spend time getting to know him. Going through 1 Corinthians 13 and saying, God is love. Jesus is love. And he loves me. He's patient. He's kind. And he's patient and kind with me. This is who he is. Getting to know him better and better. Memorize scripture that speaks to your particular needs. Find out where your needs. Pray that prayer at the end of Psalm 139. Show me where I'm failing, God, and raise me up. Teach me in the way of everlasting life. Find scriptures that speak to that. Our men's group has been, every few weeks, we take a week and we're gonna learn, memorize a verse or a passage out of scripture. And we don't just say, this is the one we're going to memorize, right? We don't all memorize the same thing. We say, the whole point of it is, find a passage in the scripture that speaks to you. Something we've been studying, something you've been studying on your own, whatever it is, find a passage that has been speaking to you and memorize it and come back. Tell us why. So in 2 weeks we come back, we tell them why we've memorized this passage, and we recite it. What a benefit that has given me. I've gotten a lot out of it. We've done it twice. First time I memorized Psalm 1, which sounds impressive. It's only 6 verses. It's short. We memorized Proverbs 30, chapter or verses 8 and 9. These are passages that have reached me and spoke to me, and I've been going through them. And so at night, I haven't forgotten them yet. At night, I go through them. There's the reason I started with Psalm 1, because it says you should delight in the law of the Lord and meditate on it day and night. That was a good reminder. So at day and night, I try to go through these things that I memorized. Not because I had a test, not because I wanted to impress somebody, but because I God was teaching me something through these passages, and I wanted to remember them. I wanted to think about them. I wanted to mull them over. I don't want to have to open up my Bible or pull out my phone and look them up every time I want to think about it and see what God's trying to teach me here. I memorize it and make it a part of me. This is how we get to know who love is. And I encourage you to do that. Remember 1 John, he says, "This is real love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sins." This is who we're dealing with here. This is the kind of God that we're dealing with here. That he's serious about sin. He's serious about our morality. And he's serious about his love. And he takes care of that through sacrificing on his own. That's real love. We don't love him first. He loves us first. While we were his enemies, he sent his son to save us. This is who we need to get to know. All right, we'll stop there for today. If you're a guest here, that's awesome. We have these, well, even if you're not a guest, you can fill out one of these cards. We're going to have a chance to have questions and comments and stuff. And if you have a comment that you want to make and you don't feel comfortable with a microphone or whatever, or if we don't have time, feel free to fill out one of these cards. Give us some feedback. You can drop it in the bag when it comes around. That bag is also for us to financially support our church. But if you're a guest, we're not asking you for money. We don't want your money. You're a guest. So we just feel free to drop that thing in the comment card in there and pass it on by. All right, so parents, if you have kids in Oasis, make sure you pick them up by 11:45. That way the Oasis workers can pack up and get out of here on time. They get hungry, just like everybody else. So if you have a question or a comment, all right, something you'd like to share, raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone.
You know, when I think of someone who has treated me these ways, they're patient, they're kind, they're not pushy and arrogant.
Yeah.
They let me know I'm important. One of the results of that is they have credibility with me. So, you know, other than the fact that God wants us to treat people this way, one of the end results, if we do that, is we're going to have credibility with people.
Yeah.
And then when we want to share something with them, they're going to tend to listen.
Yeah.
So to me, one of the best reasons to do this with people is so that we can help point them toward Jesus. And there are lots of different ways to do that. I'm not just saying share the gospel verbally, although that's one. But if we will build relationships with people and gain credibility, those are the relationships we have where people are going to tend to listen when we plant a seed.
Yeah, I agree. You know, you see these ads on TV or whatever, celebrities telling you to give to this or give to that, and I don't give that a lot of credence. Why? Because they live in mansions, right? They've got millions of dollars. When they're living the lifestyle that I have to live, if I were to give to those things, then maybe I'll listen, but they don't. And so it's the ones who really live out the lifestyle that they promote. These are the people who have credibility, and those are the ones we want to listen to. And you're absolutely right. If you want to have credibility with someone, love them. Love them like this. And that involves admitting when you're wrong. It involves apologizing. That's the kind of thing that gets people's attention because it's rare these days. Other comments or questions? It's just a loving group. Everybody's ready to love. No questions. Way over here.
Okay, so one of the things I love about this passage, mm-hmm. The first three verses, I think a lot of people in culture would hear that and say, yeah, you know, I know love is it. Love is the right answer.
Right.
But they don't really have a sound definition for what that means. What is love?
Right.
And then, of course, 4 through 7 give us really effective definition.
Yes.
Yeah. This is the love I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. These types of self-sacrificial choices.
Right.
And so there is no ambiguity in what's being described
right.
when we say we love this way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do love that about how this text is written. Also, your focus on the word patient and long-suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm someone who's tempted to maybe pat myself on the back here or there regarding some long-suffering relationships in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a teenager, too, and there's a lot of long-suffering that goes with that. And just lately, I've realized that yeah, you know, I didn't quit. I was tempted to quit on this relationship and haven't, but I really haven't been loving. I've been tolerant barely, mm-hmm. and that's not loving.
Right.
And so, yeah, I have growth needed.
You and me both, man. I mean, yeah, we think, well, we hung in there. Good for me, pat myself on the back. But let's face it, I've checked out. I've checked out plenty of times when people get on my nerves or they've, you know, I'm allowed to now be short with this person or write them off or distance myself from them or whatever. That's not long-suffering. That's just putting up with, you know, with people. That's not the same as love, not even close. Our culture thinks tolerance and love are the same thing, and they're far from each other. Tolerance, I can tolerate you as long as you're not in my face too much. But loving you is seeking. Love is active. Love is looking for ways that I can serve, looking for ways that I can help, looking for ways that I can, ways that are painful for me, but helpful to you. That's what love is. Shoot, I can't do that. That's well beyond my means. That's why we have to. It's impossible without God. Yep. Up here.
Adam, thank you for your reminder about setting goals. I know when I agree with what Steve just said about failures with regard to sharing love and being sacrificially loving of others. But I do know that a technique that impressed me was actually setting goals and then being accountable to my fellow believers with how successful I was.
Yeah.
In following through on those goals that I set for myself. And it's not that I need to be set up and flogged for failures. When I do this with other believers, they always fall upon the grace of God to remind me that, yeah, you failed, but pray to God and ask for his help, and those setting of goals will be really beneficial in the final runs.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know,
thank you.
If you have trouble wondering, you know, how do I set goals for love, just think about, when was the last time I was uncomfortable for someone else? When was the last time I just did something that I didn't want to do for someone else? There's something. There's a goal. Look for ways that you can just do something that you don't necessarily feel like doing, because love is not about how you feel. It's about doing what you know is right despite how you feel. Feelings come and go. That's why he doesn't describe love as something you'll know when you have it, which is things that are trite things that our culture will tell you. Just know when you've got it, or you'll be there, or whatever. That's nonsense. That's emotions. Our emotions are all over the place. They change from moment to moment. Love is consistent no matter how we tend to feel. It's not incompatible with our feelings. In fact, I think the more you serve someone, the more you stay with them, the more you have those feelings. Just like the more you get in there with God and get to know him better, the more your feelings toward him will grow. But it's doing things that we don't want to necessarily do for someone. There's a goal. There's a loving goal that you can set, and it's not too hard to see whether you're doing it. Any other comments? Back here.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I was just wondering, what would you say to somebody who, you know, might be thinking, man, you know, I've just really blown it too far, and God would never accept me the way that I am or love me because I'm not lovable.
Yeah.
How would you talk to that person?
Well, I would say you're in good company, because the truth is all of us are there, right? All of us, every single one of us, nobody deserves God's love. That if we deserved it, it wouldn't be loving. It would be a paycheck. It would be something we've earned, and that we've spent a long time today talking about something that you it's not something that you earn. It's not something, a relationship with God is not something that you could work for and receive as a reward. It's something that you receive because he loves you despite everything that we do. He loves you anyway. He chooses to, just as we have to choose to love others, he chose to love us. I love how he describes Israel in the Old Testament, how he uses the word chesed, which is it's loving kindness, it's often translated as. But he says to them, I love you because I love you. Which, on the one hand, is like, oh, that's nice. On the other hand, it's like, you know, it's not because I'm awesome. It's not because I'm such a dynamic person. No, he loves us because he loves us, because he chooses to. And you don't have to earn it, and you can't earn it. And if you're at that point where you think, today, I've done too much, I can't be forgiven, I can't be loved, then you're right in the way, in such, you're right in a way that you're in a better place than a lot of Christians get to. Because most Christians, after a while, they get comfortable with God's love, they get comfortable with his grace, and they kind of feel like they deserve it. It's when we understand that we don't deserve it, that we can't get it on our own. And then that next step is to say, but he loves us anyway, that he forgives us anyway, because he went to great lengths to send Christ to die for us, to so that I could have a relationship with him anyway. How fantastic. That's honestly a good place to be, because that relief then, once we get to that, he died for me, even though he knows everything I've done. He loves me even though he knows everything I've done. That's transformative love right there. Yeah, up here.
One of my big sin areas is pride. I have a lot of pride. And I said that to one of my home church leaders when we were still in Dayton. I said, nobody can love me. God can't love me because I've done too much. And the home church leader looks at me and says, oh, God can't love you? That's one of the biggest parts of pride, that God cannot love me because I'm too bad, or I've done too much, is that God cannot love me.
Yeah.
And God is love.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was really stunned by that, and it's something I really go back to often, because I'm like, you know, that's true. What makes me so special that God can't love me if God loves everything?
Right, and that's a great point. You know, that's just another form of pride to say, well, I am the one that is just me. You know, God can love everybody else. Look, there is nobody that's beyond God's love. He's infinite. He can do whatever he likes, and he likes to love us. That's fantastic. Yeah. All right, let's take a moment to pray together. If you'd like to pray out loud, raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone.